It's tough in this time. Like, I think we get also, like, you turn on the news and there's so much, I think we shut down. But in our own, you know, daily lives, the more that we can listen and be humble and own how much we don't know, I think the more that can bring to other folks and other experiences.
I'm J.R. Jameson. Today on The Facing Project, I sit down with filmmaker Colin Askey, who directed the PBS documentary Love in the Time of Fentanyl, and we're joined by Sarah Blythe and Trey Helton from the Overdose Prevention Society, the harm reduction organization featured in the film that brings people in from the streets and saves lives by providing a safe and welcoming place to use drugs. Stay with us.
Overdose Prevention Society, a place where you can overdose safely. If you're overdosing, lying panicked on the floor, don't worry, some of us have also overdosed before. Take a big deep breath, the ambulance is on its way. No need to panic just cause you can't breathe. We got Narcan kits and they're handing them out for free. OD, 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 Overdose Prevention Society.
This season I'm doing something a little different to mix up our format. I'll still share stories from past Facing projects to shine a light on specific topics and issues, but also I'll sit down for long-form interviews with best-selling authors, filmmakers, and other artists who are using their platforms to make the world a more understanding and empathetic place. Asking each of them, how do we create a more empathetic world in a time when listening has decreased and each person's message is competing with millions of others? Today's guests are filmmaker Colin Askey, who directed the PBS documentary Love in the Time of Fentanyl, and Sarah Blythe and Trey Helton from the Overdose Prevention Society, the organization featured in the film that is the leader in the harm reduction movement in Vancouver. Affectionately known as OPS, the organization continually pushes for change and justice, offers employment and advancement opportunities for members of the downtown Eastside community, and continually works to break the stigma of addiction through empowering drug users while fighting against preconceptions of substance abuse and providing a safe and welcoming place to use drugs. That last sentence might seem controversial to some, but studies have proven that harm reduction practices and sites actually save lives and put people on a path toward recovery. In the last 25 years, over 1 million people have died from overdoses in Canada and the U.S. But as pointed out in the film, in over 35 years of operation around the world, no one has ever died of an overdose in an overdose prevention site. And according to research from Johns Hopkins University, harm reduction and treatment actually go hand in hand. At The Facing Project, we believe in authentic storytelling. And what you'll hear today is those who are actively working on the front lines of harm reduction. And that includes an F-bomb, or two, or three, those we did bleep. But listener discretion is advised. Colin Askey, Sarah Blythe, and Trey Helton, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
We're happy to be here.
Sarah, I want to start with you. You started the Overdose Prevention Society. Take me back to that time in Vancouver. What was the impetus and what did it take to get started?
By about 2016, I was running a market called the Downtown Eastside Street Market, which is like 100 plus people from the Downtown Eastside, whether it be in social housing or just people trying to buy, sell, and trade things just to make a little bit of extra cash. Because it was outside on the street, on the 2-block radius, the 0-block and the 100-block is sort of the most dense for social housing, but also homelessness. Since we were right in the middle of that, and including the alleys, we're really busy with drug users and homeless as well, and they still are now. But what had happened was because we were outside, people would come running to us. They'd be like, oh my God, there's an overdose. And they would come running to us. And then we would sometimes have Narcan and sometimes we didn't, but we knew what to do because I had worked at Insight and in some of the low barrier homeless shelters in the past. So I knew that we needed to be more organized than just having Narcan sometimes. And it just seemed to be that no matter how much Narcan we had, we needed more and we needed a full stock of Narcan. And it just became a, it just became such a regular thing that I was like, you know what, we just got to set up a tent, table and chair to handle this. And maybe a person standing there that can handle this because this is out of control. There's just so much of it happening and there's overdoses everywhere. It's becoming obviously becoming a crisis situation. And then it was so alarming that I got my partner who was like a photographer to take to sort of start to document it because we figured that documenting it would be really helpful in raising some awareness of the crisis because no one really understands it until they can see it. Mm-hmm. I think that's why photography and even media can be good at just getting the word out. So so anyways, we set up this tent, table and chairs. The we documented it, put it out there. The city said, you can't do that. You can't have a safe injection site. I said, well, it's not really a safe injection site. It's a tent, table and chairs and we'll witness people if they want, but it's not an injection site. And the province said, you can't do that. And it just back and forth, different levels of government said, you can't do that. And we just said, well, we're not doing we've basically got a medic tent. People are dying in front of us, all around us, and we're just going to do this. And you would do it if you were us. And you guys have to figure this out because. And so then the media came down and they started documenting it too. And it was obvious there was a crisis. We started taking data, like information about who was coming, how many people we saved, all of that kind of information, and started submitting it or even putting it online. I put it on Twitter. We started a GoFundMe page. Community members started giving us funding to help pay for people to be at this tent, table, and chair. And it was pretty cool because the community support and then the documenting of it and then the data, eventually the health minister at the time, Terry Lake, said he woke up at 4:30 in the morning and he was like, you know what? These guys are really, they're saving lives. We gotta support this. So they came and they supported it. And that's when we kind of started the Overdose Prevention Society.
Colin, as a filmmaker, you've used your art to shine a light on the effectiveness of the Overdose Prevention Society and other ways to think about harm reduction. What motivated you to tell this story?
So, yeah, I used to work in the downtown east side. I lived in Vancouver and worked in the neighborhood for many years. And it is a community that really means a lot to me and had a big impact on kind of who I am today. And I had moved to New York in 2016 as like a health emergency was declared in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And I remember just like, you know, seeing from afar of what was going on, knowing lots of friends and stuff that were working in the neighborhood and people had really, you know, never seen anything like this at the time. And it seemed like, you know, almost weekly hearing about people that we'd known and loved that had passed away. And I remember like watching media at the time and it was like, you know, and I don't want to take anything away from paramedics, but, you know, they're going through it as well. But like the media was like, look at these poor paramedics having to go into this community and deal with these people. And, really it was those people that, you know, as Sarah was saying, that were the first responders and the ones that were learning, training themselves to use Narcan and respond to the overdoses and take care of each other. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of what I wanted to capture. And having known Sarah and many of the people that worked at the Overdose Prevention Society, it felt like the right place to capture that. Mm-hmm. I'd done lots of videos about like harm reduction and that were more educational and awareness kind of focus stuff. And for this, I just really wanted to, you know, just kind of walk audiences through what it was really like down there. And having worked myself in these spaces, I kind of knew the magic that could happen, and beyond just the saving lives, but the care and the meaning and the employment provided, and all the connections, and also the laughter and all that stuff that goes on. I think it's frustrating having worked in harm reduction and all that sort of thing too. I think the frustrating part is it's hard enough to do this work, let alone having to deal with all the people that really don't understand what the work entails and how important it is. Mm-hmm. And who the people most affected and most vulnerable are. So I hope that it would be able to reach larger audiences than what I've been able to, and shed a light on that.
Mm-hmm. I did appreciate how you captured the unique personalities of different individuals in the film. I mean, we saw funny, we saw smart, we saw witty, we saw creative. It really humanized them and pulls the viewer into their lives, and we care about them. And at the same time, you didn't hold back at all from showing the realities of addiction, including capturing moments when folks are injecting and in some cases actively overdosing. Talk about your process of making the film, and to your point earlier about changing hearts and minds, as this was being premiered, have you seen folks change just by the moment of watching the film?
Yeah. So I think those were all tough choices. And I knew early on that I definitely wanted to, for me, being in that space is always been I come from a background of abstinence-based, 12-step treatment. And when I came to harm reduction, I had a lot of reactions to it because it went against everything that I was taught, and had those same kind of, I think, the ideas that a lot of people have when they hear about this work. But for me, being able to, have those experiences and work in this field and question all of those reactions really is what kind of, I think, opened my mind to it and really enabled me to see the importance of this. And so I was kind of how to visually walk people through my experience of that. And a lot of that was, I think, just, the downtown East Side as a whole and ops was really focused, but it really represents the neighborhood. Is it's a beautiful community filled with, more love and resilience and compassion than I've ever experienced anywhere else. And it's also really funny and weird, and I think that's part of the beauty of it. And so that was always something I wanted to, embrace. And then as far as people using it, I think it was what is real? What is real about this situation and this space? It's tough to do a documentary about an overdose prevention site without showing drug use, mm-hmm. but I definitely wanted to be respectful and didn't really go around asking people. And when people offered it, it was, it was captured, I felt in a way of who the person is beyond this, because everyone in there is so much more than, just someone using drugs. And that's often how where that ends for media is just at their drug use. Mm-hmm. And for folks like Dana and a lot of people that were overdosing was really tough to capture. I don't know. It's just trying to avoid, faces and stuff like that. But, that really felt awful as a human being trying to do that. But mm-hmm. also, again, I think it's important to see what the Trey and Sarah go through every day, mm-hmm. But when we were editing the movie, we made sure the Danas and all the people that were using or, recognizable in those vulnerable situations got to see what that would look like. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have those conversations with them, with the Dana, I think, you were mentioning with, injecting into his neck, mm-hmm. it's a tough scene for people, but also think if you see that and you also see that same person saving lives and being a funny, intelligent, beautiful human being, hopefully that people, question their reactions a bit about seeing that drug use,
Mm-hmm. I consider myself a fairly open-minded person. I know folks here in my own community who work with harm reduction, but my jaw did drop when I saw him whistling the Andy Griffith theme song, and he's kind of closing up the site for the evening, and then he injects in his neck. Were you worried at all, Colin, about including scenes like that, knowing that there are naysayers and somebody might grab that one scene? You know, I'm thinking about, I work in publishing too, and I think about right now with book banning, people just grab like a small, right, like excerpt from a book, and they're like, this book should be banned because of this scene. Were you worried at all about a naysayer grabbing a clip like that and only focusing on that one moment in time to try to prove their point that would be maybe counter to the movement? Or are you hopeful that that initial shock factor will actually open more hearts and minds?
Yeah, I think like, going to the responses, like for the most part, people that are new to this, you know, were definitely appreciative of that. And I think it's like, I didn't want to, like a lot, like I was mentioning before, a lot of the stuff I've been doing was educational and trying to, being so worried about how things looked and people, you know, being vulnerable and stuff like that. And I think audiences, you know, appreciate it when you're honest with them. And I think that that is just an honest scene of Dana. And to just, you know, pick out one piece of that is I think you're missing out on the whole story. And most people, I think, appreciated that. And the responses for people that were new to this were like really, you know, talked about a huge perspective shift, not only on people who use drugs, but on this issue as a whole. And especially in the US, that was, it's been beautiful to hear because there's, you know, this work is so controversial and attacked really. And there's definitely been a few of those where, you know, like in Medford, Oregon, they tried, a harm reduction organization tried to have a screening at a public library and received death threats. And the people had never seen the movie. It's just that the idea, people have this idea of harm reduction and it's going to just end society. And it's, I think, an example and an aspect of how, you know, deeply divided this country is and how kind of evidence is now at odds with, well, always kind of has been, but, you know, evidence versus ideology has reached this level where no one actually bothers learning about something. They just like, this is what I believe and this is the side I'm on without watching it. And I think luckily we were able through this, through PBS and stuff, to reach a large audience that was new to this and for the most part had been super supportive and their eyes have been opened in a good way. And also like lots of questions like why aren't we having more of this in the US? This crisis has been going on forever. And, you know, in Canada, I think there's been more time to learn about this stuff. But in the US, harm reduction is very new. Mm-hmm. And the people are like, you know, why do we keep doing the same thing? It's they're pretty sick of the amount of grief and loss that's been going on. And overdose prevention sites are one small tool, you know, that needs to be so much more. So that's frustrating, is that like people get hung up on just one kind of thing when we need to, there needs to be so much change that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for listeners who maybe aren't familiar with harm reduction to understand that it actually does save lives. I mean, all the data points to that, right? That it does save lives. And during the filming of Love in the Time of Fentanyl, this was said in the film that 175 people in Vancouver died in a one-month period from fentanyl overdoses. And in the last 25 years, over 1 million people have died from overdoses in Canada and the U.S. But as you pointed out, too, in over 35 years of operation around the world, no one has ever died from an overdose prevention site. But I don't think that most people understand how much fentanyl is out there and how deadly it actually is. There's just a lack of understanding. I want to play a short audio clip, actually, from the film where Dana, one of the volunteers at the site, talks about this.
I mean, yeah, people were scared of it, but people weren't left with a choice, really. You can't really get heroin out there. You can, but it's really far and few between, and like everybody's addicted to fentanyl now. So it's like people aren't scared of it. They are, but they aren't, right? They crave it, they like it, but they know in the back of their minds that, you know, I mean, that's why everybody's here in the safe consumption site, not just because it's comfortable, because there's a risk, right? And there's an underlying risk that I could do this shot and be laid right out. I could die.
Trey, you created the memorial wall in the alleyway where so many folks have lost their lives. It's such a poignant space and carefully planned out to honor those who have passed on. And in many ways, it's a public statement of how many folks in Vancouver have been lost to this crisis. How has the memorial wall acted as a source of healing for survivors?
Yeah, I mean, that mural was had city support and city protection for a 2-year minimum period through the city mural program. And then after 2 years, it's not protected anymore. So it was free to be knocked over.
Wow. And there are no plans by the city or anyone else to kind of recreate that kind of memorial or tribute?
Not that I know of, no. I mean, I could ask them.
Mm-hmm. But Trey works like he does on top of all the work at OPS. He also, like, you should get him to talk about all the folks that he gets into detox and the struggles with the detox and treatment system as well. But mm-hmm. just going to the art thing, like on top of his job, he also like really supports all the downtown Eastside community artists. He has like gallery shows for them and goes out with Smokey Devil, who's like an infamous kind of graffiti artist who in the beginning of the crisis, you know, a lot of folks in the neighborhood didn't have, you know, internet or like aren't getting the news. And a lot of them learned what was going on through Smokey's like graffiti. And Trey's really, you know, gone out of his way to support him and numerous artists in the neighborhood to help, you know, as you're saying, I think it's been, I don't want to say beautiful because it's such a tragedy and such a crisis there, but mm-hmm. a really important, meaningful thing for people in a way to, be proud of the neighborhood, be proud of the responses mm-hmm. that's been so grassroots and coming from the neighborhood. And Trey's really led the artists in the neighborhood in that way.
Been doing too much, man. Doing too much. But
talk about how what that's been like, Trey, all the other stuff besides just that wall.
I just like to talk about detox. Like the bottom line is that I want to say is like if you're running an overdose prevention site or working in an SCS, there's two priorities. One, make sure nobody dies from an overdose. And two, get people into detox. Like start pumping them in there. Like you are the direct link between like recovery-based services and frontline addiction. If you're running a site, that's what you should be doing is be like, just like, hey, feeling done? Hey, you want to come to the office? You want to talk about this? You've been hitting empty for a while here. I've been watching you smash your face against the curb for years. Like it's time for a change, man. Like, and that's all I want to do is just pump people into detox. Like just over and over and over again, just get them in there, get them off the street. And, you know, the political tide is changing and, in Canada right now, it looks like it's Pierre Poilievre is kind of leading in the thing and everyone's pushing for recovery. So as much as I dislike Pierre Poilievre, I'm actually super happy that like I have the opportunity to really push recovery on people from a harm reduction standpoint, because in the past, whenever I spoke out about it, some harm reduction advocates were like, why are you pushing recovery? Stop. I was like, what the fuck is wrong with you, dude? Mm-hmm. Like, you need to get people out of this shit. Like, fuck, man. Like, if I could solve the overdose crisis, like right now with the snap of my fingers and it meant I'd be out of a job, I would fucking do it. I don't care, dude. I would mm-hmm. rather have people alive and like choosing life and having some sort of happiness. Like, it's, and I know what it's like personally, so I don't know, man. But then on the other end, you have people that are institutionalized for life that will never ever want to choose recovery. They have so much trauma. It's just like thinking about making healthier choices is an impossibility for them. Or they have chronic pain or like serious mental health stuff. And those people are the kind of people that do need safe supply. So There's not one specific solution for the overdose crisis. You need lots of different options for people. But generally, I'm really passionate about just getting people out of the system if I can and like pushing them towards recovery. And it's super frustrating. But there's been some changes in the detox access programs. Before, it was like really frustrating. They had a lot of high barriers and some things have been changed. There was a there was a 412 rule that was in place. It was really harmful. The 412 rule means that you can only apply to detox four times in a 12-month calendar year, which is like ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Like it took me multiple tries. Like, how can you limit it to four tries a year? Like, that's just so bad. And then there was also like when you left detox, like if you hit the I can't do it button and like left, you weren't allowed to reapply for a 30-day period. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. There are so many times I left detox, and like 2 hours in being on the street, I was like, I made a huge mistake. Like, I made a huge mistake. I want to go back. And
that already counted then toward one of your times.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So the 412 rule is gone. You can do endless applications in a 12-month calendar year. The 30-day wait period, if you leave, you're not allowed to come back for 30 days. That's gone. So it's really reignited my passion for trying to get people in. Like, I've always had it, but being frustrated with the system has kind of made me feel helpless. Mm-hmm. But they've gotten rid of some of that stuff. So I really made a commitment to really start really, really, like, I want to get as many people as I can. Mm-hmm. I want to set the record for like sending people to detox from an ops for 2024, but I'm starting in 2023. We've gotten between me and one of the other staff workers at ops, we've gotten, I think, six people into detox in the last 30 days, which is like a huge success.
Congrats. Yeah.
And we're just going to keep trying. So
I think that's like a really important myth for, you know, people new to, you know, what overdose prevention sites are and harm reduction is about. And like, having worked at Insight, one of the sites in Vancouver, you know, and I've been involved around, you know, had my own personal experience when I was really young and worked as a peer counselor in absence-based treatment and lots of different spaces in and around kind of substance use and addiction. And never have I seen more people referred to treatment than I did at Insight in the safe injection site. And it's a place where, you know, people first feel welcome and not judged. And so that's kind of the place where they learn to trust the staff and the people there. And that's where they come when they need other connections and other services. And it's people like Trey that are able to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. Like, I recently went and talked to the Access Central staff that do intakes for detox, and like one of their big frustrations from their end that they felt that I think is important to talk about is that once you get someone into like the detox system or the healthcare system for detox from street substances, and say they go through the detox period like a week or 2 weeks, whatever, and then they make an application to go to second stage housing, there's only two options. It's complete abstinence-based recovery, whereas if you use, you get kicked out. Or it's like, we can get you housing in an SRO, and that's if you're lucky. So it's the two most opposite ends of the spectrum. Sending someone to SRO housing where you're going to be victimized, have everyone around you using drugs, setting you up for failure, or sending you to a complete abstinence-based program where you'll get kicked out if you slip. So there needs to be more middle ground from that perspective. Like some sort of middle-based second-stage housing where it's not completely abstinence-based recovery, but it's affordable to live in with some sort of oversight, but not heavy duty oversight. So there needs to be some changes on that end too. Mm.
Do you see a movement toward that happening?
No, but I'm just going to keep talking about it, and hopefully someone listens eventually, because I've been talking about how the 412 rule and the 30-day reapplication program with detox is super harmful for years now, and finally someone listened to me and they did something. So I don't know, just keep talking about it, right? Mm-hmm. Eventually, hopefully, they'll stop putting all this money towards studying the overdose crisis and actually doing something about it with that cash, like Sarah keeps talking about. It's like $55 million to study the overdose crisis. Like, you could do so much more.
Wow. One thing that I found fascinating too about ops is it's so much more than a harm reduction site. You also provide other wraparound services. Can you talk a bit more about what that looks like?
Well, I mean, like wraparound services in terms of like, we can get them an outreach worker. We can try to help them apply to get housing. Unfortunately, it's always SRO stuff. It's not the greatest. Detox, second stage treatment options, safe supply options, which are being attacked right now, like every day. But I don't know, safe supply does work for some people. Like it's, it is helpful for some people. But I don't know, maybe Sarah can answer that.
We help people get housing. We help people get in medical care. We visit people at the hospital. I mean, every kind of gray area situation that you could possibly imagine that people come up with and come in with, we help people. You know, I was helping people negotiate issues with some of the staff that live in housing yesterday that they were having, you know, with their landlords and keeping people in the housing that they have, and, you know, talking through police situations and giving advice on certain things. So I think just whatever kind of comes up for people, whether it be like, you know, someone needs a hip replacement and needs some support, or even clothing or food, or we have trade as pet. If our pets are in distress, then people are more in distress. So, and there's a lot of pets down here. So there's, you know, we just got 10,000 pounds of dog food donated. And so we're just always like, when someone comes in and they've got a problem, whether it be a heart condition or whatever, a psychosis, like we can monitor people's mental health. So if they're going completely, you know, if we feel like things are changing, their symptoms are changing, they're getting worse, and they might get psychotic. We get to know maybe the people that are surrounding them, their counselors, and we can send them to their counselors. We can help them get to the hospital. We can monitor all of these situations. And that goes for all the peers, can help monitor each other and make sure that, hey, this guy's attitude's been changing these days. We got to look at what's happening with him. He doesn't really act like this. What's going on? You know, just individual situations and bigger situations. And we also connect to government officials, and because there's so many people, up to 900 people a day that are walking through our site, we can gather all of that information that we hear from people, like the change of drugs, the change of like violence, gang violence against people. We can take all that information and we can tell the government that, listen, this is what's happening, this is what's happening, this is what's happening, this is what we need. And sometimes they listen and sometimes they don't. And sometimes like the things that we say we need are so foreign to them that it's really hard for them to understand that we're actually serious about some of the things that we need. So that's kind of a complicated thing. It's just, you know, it's just everything everyone needs at the time of need.
Have you ever had any government officials or people in power shadow either one of you for a day to see what a day in the life is like for ops?
No, we've had lots of visits from like big wigs, lots of walkthroughs, and then we can tell them what we need the most. But no one's ever shadowed me. That'd be fun.
I mean, it just seems to me if somebody like did, I know. I mean,
if they shadowed Trey for the day, like it probably would be too much information that they wouldn't understand. Right. They would not understand. They would be like, this is crazy. And they would not like it would, you know, it would, they'd have to shadow them for weeks and weeks and weeks to try and figure out what's going really going on. It's very complicated stuff.
I've had people shadow me before for like healthcare reasons. And the answer is always the same. They're like, how the f- do you do this? Like, how the f- do you do this? This is I want to light my hair on fire.
But, you know, but Trey, remember, like yesterday we were like, oh, you know, talking about people wanting to work at ops, like there's a never ending lineup of people who are like, we support you, we'd love to work with you at the same time. I'm like, really? Like it's like crazy to me because it's
yeah, they say that, but can they actually do it? when they actually see what it entails,
they run away.
Do you think that's why, or at least what I got from the film, is that many of your volunteers are either active drug users or former? Do you think that's why? Because they've walked that path, they understand it, and they can be Absolutely. In this process versus somebody who, like we were just talking about, just this is a completely foreign concept to them, wouldn't be able to take in everything and process it in a way as someone who has walked that path has gone through. Do you think that's a bit of the fear too?
Absolutely. I think, like, if you look at someone like Dana, who's still here doing this, or you think someone like Ronnie, who has never really, like, been a drug user like that, so he doesn't really understand. So he's got all, like, he comes from a more of a place of a privilege where he has time off and he has like a 9-to-5 and, you know, there's all sorts of benefits. And so he just gets into this, people get into this role of like, needing support and needing more support. Whereas someone who's on the front lines is just, this is like something they do every day and they understand it. And they're from here and they're down here and they live here and they work here. And the longevity for that is just a lot, especially in this work, is a lot more. There's so much more understanding and so much more capability of dealing with frontline stuff when you've actually been a drug user or a former drug user, that someone that's been like on the street and has that complete understanding of like what it's like is just so much different than when we've, you know, hired folks to come in and or even volunteers that need more than that.
Mm-hmm. Trey, there's a moment in the film that is so heartfelt where one individual is hospitalized and you take his chair to him. And so when I talk about wraparound services, that's kind of a wraparound service too that, you know, I was thinking about that I don't think some people understand. Like if somebody is an active drug user and they maybe have other issues happening in their lives, other people have abandoned them. And so they may not have somebody who could take their chair to them when they need their chair or want their chair. Can you talk a bit about that moment in the film?
Oh yeah. Ron, when I visit Ron in the hospital, St. Paul's is like my second home. Like, I don't know, dude, I was just there and we had 5 staff members in the same hospital. So it was like 3 of them were on the same floor. Gord, Dana were on the same floor with Gord had pneumonia. Dana had an arm infection. Our former staff member and supervisor, Rodney Beamish, just passed. He had terminal throat cancer. Me and Sarah were with him for the last 2 days of his life, visiting him, playing music for him. I brought Zelda. Zelda was laying on him as he, like the day before he died, she was up on the hospital bed sitting with him. And then Eddie Lakes was on the 10th floor. Jezre was on the 10th floor. It was just this endless like hospital visit. So yeah, I'm there a lot, or like taking, like I'll actually take time, like if somebody wants to do rapid access to detox, I'll go sit there with them for 4 hours on my day off.
Yeah,
so like yeah, I spend a lot of time at St. Paul's.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a lot of people don't have family members. So, I mean, like that scene in Love in the Time of Fentanyl isn't staged. It's real. It's very much what I do. And I do that without cameras present.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's moments like that that help people who maybe don't understand the crisis or understand the work that you're doing to begin to empathize with it. And I do want to end our conversation on empathy. The basis of the work that I do as a storyteller is steeped in empathy. But I often think and I wonder about empathy in the current world that we are living in. And it seems like we're getting farther and farther away from an empathetic society. It seems like people are drawing lines in the sand and deciding to be on one side or the other without truly empathizing or understanding different point of views. So I'm asking all of my guests this season a question. I'd love to hear the answer from each of you. There's no right answer to this. It's just speaking from your heart on how you feel. How do we create a more empathetic world in a time when it feels like listening and understanding the lives of others has actually decreased?
I think like empathy starts with us and kind of acknowledging what we don't know. Like it starts with, I think, humility. And I think that's a big problem and a lot of inspiration for this film and a lot of what you've probably heard today and hopefully some of it translated, because I think that's the biggest obstacle with this issue is trying to transfer or translate the reality of what it's actually like for folks. I think like this idea of how we deal with addiction or this crisis stems from people's own understandings and own experiences, where they may have had an aunt that went to an AA meeting and everything was fine. So why can't everyone else do that? And I think like the downtown East Side community is a community of people that, you know, have been rejected from a lot of places, that have been failed, have fallen through the cracks and have been through things that, you know, I had that same idea when I came to the neighborhood because of my own experiences, and then really learned of what life can actually be like for poor folks and stories that you most people I don't think could even fathom. And that's, you know, you can't walk down the block without a million of those stories. And there are stories that are horrible and tragic that people have had to go through that, but also incredibly courageous. And that's what makes that community so beautiful, is that people are surviving. And it's a proud community, despite the, you know, this crisis and the numerous challenges it's faced, it's still there, you know, and like a lot of communities of that, you know, it's filled with people that face those challenges, and impoverished communities are gentrified, and they don't exist. And the downtown East Side has survived for many years because it's proud and it fights and it for the right to exist and be there, and it takes care of each other. But yeah, I think like getting just back to empathy, I think we got to acknowledge how much we don't know, and that all our experiences are different. And that comes from more than just imagining. It's really listening. And, the biggest frustration and goal of this film is just to try in some way to like communicate that, there's some really beautiful human beings that are, kind of just cast aside, and they thank God for people like Trey and Sarah that show up every day for it, but they're going through it too, you know. They need the understanding too, not this division and hate that they receive, like death threats. The film, people tried to do a screening in a library and received death threats, you know, like with people that probably have never been to an overdose prevention site, just read about harm reduction and thought it was something and decided to bring hate to those folks that are, you know, also on their front lines with not even close to the amount of services that, you know, Vancouver does. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I could go on, but yeah, like, it's tough in this time. Like, I think we get also like, you turn on the news and there's so much crap that, I think we shut down, but in our own, you know, daily lives, the more that we can listen and be humble and own how much we don't know, I think the more hopefully that can bring to other folks and other experiences.
Mm-hmm. Trey or Sarah?
Come on, Trey.
I mean, empathy is, like Colin said there, it's hard to get unless you've been there. So I'm always encouraging anyone that that comes down to ops to make sure that they create peer employment for people with lived experience to build them up and give them a place.
How do we help other people? Well, I don't know. We educate people, like the story that like I would say Love in the Time of Fentanyl shows a humanistic, like introducing people to people, bringing people to the site to meet people. I often, people say I'd like to, you know, donate somehow or volunteer. And usually I'll just say, come down to the site and meet everyone. And I think, you know, talking to people, helping people, being a part of things, like meeting, you know, meeting people and seeing and hearing their stories and is really creates an empathy in people who may not empathize because they don't have lived experience or that kind of understanding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, meeting people like Norma, meeting people like Dana, meeting people from the community like Robert, who sweeps all of the, you know, sweeps the front of everything. And he's such a wonderful human being. And we have so many wonderful human beings that are human beings. And then people just think of drugs as like, you know, bad overall, but they don't understand that there's a real human and a lot of tragedy and a lot of other things involved with drug use. And I think you create empathy through bringing people together. And then there's the empathy where, you know, you're just, you've grown up, you've had a difficult life experience yourself, you've had your own drug use problems, you've had your own, you know, bulimia or like, you know, I don't, mm-hmm. ADHD or mental health issues where you're like, you know, I've had a really hard life. I get what having a really hard life. Like I talked to a woman today about going to detox and then what it was like to, you know, what she needed to do to maybe disconnect to some family members that were really challenging in her life. And I could understand that because I've had challenging family life myself mm-hmm. to some degree. And so I think like just that kind of empathy where you can understand from like a human, even a mother or a compassionate level that you've experienced some difficult times in your life and that you can then, they can then say, oh my God, you totally understand me. Mm-hmm. And that's like true, real empathy. And, or else Trey, you know, who's been on the street, he's done everything everybody else has done. He's had to live in, you know, live on the street and God knows what he was up to. I heard he was a bit of a wild man, hard to deal with. And so, like people can come to, you know, will come to him and say, oh my God, I, you know, that hadn't seen him for a while and say, oh my God, like you're doing amazing. And I'm so inspired by you. And someday I really hope, like you get so many people hoping that they can just get to where Trey's at. Mm-hmm. And that's where someone like Trey is so much more important than someone who hasn't been through those things. And that, you know, like he has inspired so many people to go into recovery themselves because they're like, holy fuck, if that guy mm-hmm. can do it, so can I. Right, Trey?
Yeah.
You know, and if you can do it. And then when they're in recovery, Trey knows exactly what they've been through. So that's another kind of empathy. Like, yes, I know. Oh my God, I know what you're feeling. I've felt that way too. And it felt like this. And this is what I did when I felt like that. Mm-hmm. And this is how I continued, you know, if people come out, yeah, I came out of recovery 10 times and this is what I did to get myself back in. And this is how the steps I took to forgive myself and be able to go back into recovery again. And that's just, there's no training. You can't, there's no psychiatrist. There's no any kind of education that can equal that for mm-hmm. helping people. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Colin Askey, documentary filmmaker and director of Love in the Time of Fentanyl, and Sarah Blythe and Trey Helton, both with the Overdose Prevention Society in Vancouver, British Columbia. Thank you so much for joining me on the Facing Project and telling your story.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Love in the Time of Fentanyl is out now on PBS Independent Lens, more at pbs.org. More about the Overdose Prevention Society at vancityops.com.
Overdose Prevention Society. A place where you can overdose safely. If you're overdosing, lying panicked on the floor, don't worry, some of us have also overdosed before. Take a big deep breath. The ambulance is on its way. No need to panic just 'cause you can't breathe. We got Narcan kits in the hand and them out for free. OD, OD, OD. Overdose Prevention Society.
Many thanks once again to Colin Askey, Sarah Blythe, and Trey Helton for joining me on today's show. To listen to past episodes of this program, visit indianapublicradio.org/thefacingproject, or find us on your favorite podcasting app, or just ask your smart speaker to play The Facing Project on NPR. To continue the conversation about this episode, find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Facing Project. The Facing Project is recorded at Indiana Public Radio at Ball State University in beautiful and wonderful Muncie, Indiana. And it's produced by the amazing producer and audio engineer extraordinaire, Sean Ashcraft. The show is distributed nationally through PRX. I'm your host, J.R. Jameson. And until next time, I wish you the courage to share your own story and the empathy to listen to others.